It is Monday, July the 3rd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, could more sanctions be ahead for Qatar?
It's hard to think what additional sanctions could be imposed short of actual war.
France's president in Mali to boost fight against terrorism.
This has been an effort that's been pushed by the French president for the last months to try to get five Sahel countries to agree on a multinational force.
U.S. healthcare issue plus a longtime rock and roll star out on tour. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Kuwait has received a response by Qatar to a list of demands by Arab nations accusing Doha of supporting terrorism, but has asked those countries to extend by 48 hours more a deadline for compliance. Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain agreed to that deadline extension. VOA's Victor Beatty asked David Mack, Middle East Institute scholar and former U.S. ambassador to the United Arab Emirates, for his read on the deadlines.
Oh, I think that both sides have talked themselves into positions from which it's difficult to back down, and that's has a good deal to do with the fact that, unlike in the past when matters like this have been dealt with discreetly by diplomats, this time it's being dealt with by public proclamations and statements to the media. I think that's very unfortunate, and I think this crisis can only benefit one nation in the region, and that's Iran. But it certainly is not to the advantage of Qatar, Saudi Arabia, or any other country among the Arab states of the Gulf.
Qatar is digging in. Defiance says demands made to be rejected. The U.S. also says some of the demands are unreasonable. Where do we go now?
I do agree that some of the demands seem to have been made not to get Qatari acquiescence, but to make it appear that Qatar has been totally defeated, and to punish Qatar. On the other hand, there are some things that where Qatar could probably could certainly improve its performance, but those are the kind of things that can be worked out through negotiations. It's something that Secretary of State Tillerson, for example, was certainly prepared to work upon.
Could you identify one or two, perhaps, of the demands that have been made that are unreasonable in your view?
I do think that it's asking a bit much to say that Qatar would have to eject the forces of our NATO ally, Turkey. In many respects, Turkey shares a similar interest to those of Saudi Arabia and certainly the United States in the region.
U.S. is backing Kuwaiti mediation. Will it be successful in your view?
I think that the greatest hope lies in the mediation of countries like Kuwait that have a long history of bringing Arab brothers together to the benefit of all parties.
Ambassador David Back speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty, who asked University of San Francisco scholar Stephen Zunis what further sanctions might Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain impose on Qatar.
It's hard to say. In many respects, the sanctions already imposed are extremely severe in terms of the land, sea, and air blockade, the withdrawal of diplomatic relations, suspending their membership in the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is an important strategic and economic alliance. It's hard to think what additional sanctions could be imposed short of actual war.
Qatar remains defiant, says the demands are made to be rejected. The U.S., in fact, interjected that it thought some of the demands were unreasonable. Are you surprised this feud's gone on and is becoming as serious as it is?
It is somewhat surprising that Saudi Arabia and its allies would be making such extreme demands. I mean, basically, they are demanding that Qatar compromise its sovereignty in terms of its domestic and foreign policies to suit that of the regional hegemon, which is Saudi Arabia. Many of the charges are grossly exaggerated. For example, among the list of supposed terrorist groups Qatar is supporting includes the nonviolent pro-democracy movement in neighboring Bahrain. Similarly, the demands to close Al Jazeera, which is a government-supported but editorially independent network, seems nothing short of a censorship of the media beyond the country's international borders. And while there are certainly legitimate criticisms one can make of the Qatari government regarding its ties to extremist groups and other concerns, many of these same complaints you could say about the accusers, particularly Saudi Arabia. So it would appear that Saudi Arabia and its allies have very little to stand on in terms of their demand, and they're just hoping that the overwhelming might, given the how these countries are virtually all much larger and more powerful than Qatar, might turn the tide. But so far, it appears that the state of Qatar is remaining defiant.
Stephen Zunis is an international relations scholar specializing in Middle Eastern politics, teaching at the University of San Francisco. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. French President Emmanuel Macron is in Mali to take part in talks about forming a regional anti-jihadist force. Mali, Burkina Faso, Chad, Mauritania, and Niger, the so-called G5 Sahel, have said they're coming together to provide troops to combat rising insecurity and jihadist attacks in the region. The G5 Sahel troops would bolster the 4,000 French troops and the 11,000 UN peacekeepers already operating in the region. VOA asked Hudson Institute scholar Ben Haddad if this is Macron's intention to push France to a more involved state, not only in Africa, but elsewhere internationally.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you remember, actually, his first foreign trip out of Europe was in Mali already, where France has close to 4,000 troops, and this operation's been going on for the last 5 years to fight Al-Qaeda in the Sahel. This has been an effort that's been pushed by the French president for the last months to try to get five Sahel countries to agree on a multinational force that will, you know, be around 5,000 people, 5,000 soldiers by autumn, that has a backing of a UN resolution, and he's trying to get his European partners more involved as well in this fight against terrorism in Africa. So clearly, I mean, you see on the issue of terrorism and other issues such as financial reform in Europe, he's really trying to emerge as the leader of a more united and more autonomous Europe on the international stage.
We also asked Haddad if this is an effort by France to remove its troops from Mali, its former colony.
He has said that it wasn't. I think he's trying to maybe alleviate some of the pressure on the French troops that are there, but also try to get regional partners to pitch in, regional partners in Africa, but also regional partners in Europe, who are also obviously concerned by the stability of this region and the potential consequences for, you know, in terms of terrorism and refugees for the European Union. I think in general, what Mr. Macron wants is for Europeans to finally pull their weight on the international stages, especially on the security and defense. He has pledged during his campaign to increase French defense spending to 2% of GDP by 2025, and is trying to push his partners to do the same.
We also ask Haddad if there is growing concern there about terrorist activities across Mali.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you know, the French intervened in 2013 where the country was on the brink of collapse. The Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb had already seized control of the north, and it was speeding towards Bamako. So the initial intervention managed to stem that raise and progressively establish some sort of control over the rest of the country. But we've still had various terrorist attacks, and the government is still extremely fragile. So clearly, the situation is not, you know, stable to the point where the French troops could withdraw.
Ben Haddad is a research fellow at the Hudson Institute specializing in European and transatlantic affairs. With the U.S. Congress idle this week for the July 4th holiday, that's our Independence Day, lawmakers are in their home states at a time of intense political upheaval, all of it to do with the future of health care in America. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman tells VOA's Jim Stevenson that Republicans remain in disarray over their stalled plan to repeal and replace former President Barack Obama's signature domestic achievement known as Obamacare.
Jim, VOA's headquarters are right near where the fireworks will be going off. And we already hear some loud noises when it comes to health care. Republicans have left town. They had hoped in the Senate to pass some form of Obamacare repeal and replacement. However, the bill that was put forward in the Senate was scored by the Congressional Budget Office as causing millions of Americans to lose their health care coverage. And in particular, the vulnerable, the elderly, the disabled, these are people who would be hurt, according to this nonpartisan scorekeeping analysis. Republicans retreated, said that they needed more time to work on the bill, and there was some thought that they might try to put more money in for Medicaid, more money in for various health crises in the country, such as the opioid abuse epidemic, and perhaps retain some of the taxes that were imposed by Obamacare in order to pay for all of this. But it's not clear whether Republicans can come to any sort of sweet spot on this, because the more they move the bill to the left, the more conservatives are going to revolt against it. The more they move it to the right, the more moderate Republicans are going to revolt against it. There are 52 Republican senators. At most, they can afford to lose two of them on a health care vote and prevail when it comes to repealing Obamacare.
This was a big campaign issue of Donald Trump's. It seems in watching this play out that the White House has almost left this more to the Hill to decide, as opposed to really setting any firm agenda out of the White House itself.
The White House has been somewhat hands-off, although President Trump did tweet, as he's prone to do, and in the estimation of Republicans, his tweets have not been helpful. At the very time when Republicans were struggling to come up with some sort of formula before they left town to resuscitate this bill, the president tweeted that, well, maybe what they should do is just repeal Obamacare first and worry about replacement later. And for Senate Republicans who are going home to hear their constituents, who definitely believe that there should be some health care policy in the place of Obamacare, whether it's repealed or not, that was precisely the wrong message from their perspective. So the White House has been somewhat hands-off, but if you talk to Senate aides on the Hill, I think a number of them are frustrated in that, from their perspective, the contributions that have been coming from Pennsylvania Avenue have not been particularly productive to the legislative process.
And all of these representatives are going home to July 4th festivities, where presumably a good number of them are going to be in front of crowds trying to celebrate America's birthday, but at the same time be under fire for what's going on in Washington.
In 2009-2010, when the Democrats were struggling to pass a health care bill, they went home to very angry crowds. and a number of them had to cancel town hall events entirely. And you could sort of tell who was who by who was having a town hall event, who was actually getting up in front of crowds and facing the music. Republicans were very eager to speak out then, Democrats much less so. The reverse is true today. I don't know that there are no Republicans that are holding town hall meetings. I'm sure that there are, but the number has been ratcheted down tremendously because they know right now if they get up in front of a crowd of 200, 300, 400 constituents, they're going to get a fair amount of grief. And it is Democrats who are getting up, standing up, and wanting to highlight what they see as the flaws of this entire Republican initiative.
We wish everyone a happy 4th of July holiday and all of the festivities that go with it. Free speech, part of it, and we freely listen to the speech of Michael Bowman each and every week, our VOA Senate correspondent. Michael, thank you.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Indeed. Free speech. It's a big thing. Thanks, guys. Time now for what's trending on social media with Free Speech All the Way, VOA's Lori London.
Hi, Steve. Well, President Trump's use of social media is actually what is trending on social media today. The president on Sunday tweeted a mock video that shows him pummeling a man in a business suit and the man's face replaced by the CNN cable news network logo outside of a wrestling ring. Now, the video is actually from 2007 during a professional WrestleMania event where Trump did perform outside the wrestling ring in a fake match. Now, in Sunday's version, the CNN logo is superimposed on the head of Trump's opponent as Trump, wearing a business suit, pounds away in fake punches before walking away triumphantly. Now, the post that Trump tweeted also called the CNN television network Fraud News Network. As you know, he has been consistently calling a lot of these networks out as fake news. Now, it's not clear who actually produced the video, but it was posted from Trump's official Twitter account and then retweeted by the official @POTUS account.
Lori, what's the reaction been?
Lots of condemnation, really. Bruce Brown, the executive director of Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, called the post, quote, a threat of physical violence against journalists and said it was beneath the office of the presidency. And he also said no one should be threatened with physical harm for doing their jobs. Now, CNN also responded. A network spokesman said, quote, it's a sad day when the president of the United States encourages violence against reporters. The spokesperson added that Trump is involved in juvenile behavior far below the dignity of his office. We will keep doing our jobs. He should start doing his. Now, you know, in recent days and weeks, Trump's been lashing out at the press and particularly stepping up his anger toward the television cable networks. His latest lashing against CNN came after days of attacks on two anchors of the Morning Joe talk show on MSNBC, Mika Brzezinski and her fiancé, Joe Scarborough. Trump's tweet maligning the intellect and appearance of Brzezinski really drew widespread condemnation from both Democrats and even Republicans. But the White House and Trump himself have continued to defend the comments. Many people, though, calling the tweets beneath the dignity of the office of the president. But Trump himself tweeted this weekend a response to the criticism, saying, quote, my use of social media is not presidential. It's, in caps, modern day presidential. Make America great again.
Many thanks to you, Lori, VOA's Lori London. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to the website water.org, 1 in 10 people in the world don't have access to safe water. It's common knowledge that drinking water that has been contaminated with harmful bacteria can make you quite sick. In areas of the world where there is little medical care, this could become a life or death situation. While there has been some success with chemical water treatment, such as adding chlorine to unclean water, bacteria has a way of building up a resistance to such efforts, making the little bugs hard to get rid of. Spanish researchers, experimenting with self-propelled micromotors, have developed tiny swimming robots that they say can detect and remove harmful bacteria from contaminated water without the need for chemicals or other potentially harmful elements. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us today. Now a bit from our music department and an American rock and roll legend taking her songs on tour. Stephanie Lynn Nicks, better known as Stevie Nicks, and generally regarded as the queen of rock and roll. Nicks was born in Phoenix, Arizona in 1948 and was well on her way to becoming an A-list singer-songwriter in her mid-teens.
The day I got my Goya guitar, I wrote a song on my 16th birthday.
Boy, you can be that specific.
Yeah, I didn't even sing you the song, but I'm not going to.
It was that good, huh?
Well, yeah. It had potential. It had a really good melody. The words were incredibly, incredibly tried, but I was in love. You know, so it was just totally stupid. I've loved and I've lost, and I'm sad but not blue, sort of ridiculous. But it was pretty. And I actually sat and played it for my friend Robin, and she said, potential. This could be happening. And so I said that from that moment onward, I just was, you know, had the guitar under one arm all the time.
Soon afterwards, she partnered with guitarist Lindsey Buckingham to become Buckingham Nicks. A few years later, they joined the British rock band Fleetwood Mac, with Stevie quickly becoming the main singer. Gypsy was one of Fleetwood Mac's biggest hits. In 1981, while remaining a member of Fleetwood Mac, Nicks began her solo career out on tour as she is this year. Dreams is always on the tour playlist.
Down.
Stevie Nicks is a prolific songwriter, but no matter how many songs she writes and records, Landslide remains her biggest hit.
Took this love and I took it down. I climbed a mountain and I turned around. And I saw my reflection in the snow-covered hills till the landslide brought me down. Oh, mirror in the sky, what is love?
You have any idea what that song means? I don't know. But I like it anyway, don't you? Thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now it's time for a bit more of Stevie Nicks.
Editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. This is one of a series on the U.S. Constitution and the structure of the U.S. government.
To protect individual rights, the framers of the United States Constitution added 10 amendments to the document, which came into force in 1792, 3 years after the Constitution itself did. These amendments are collectively named the Bill of Rights. Arguably, the First Amendment is also the most important to the maintenance of a democratic government. It states that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. The first part of that statement reflects the framers' experience with the long history of religious strife in Europe. They realized that religious discord can be explosive and cause tremendous disruption in politics. It would be doubly so if one religious sect were favored over all others. So they argued that the federal government cannot interfere in the citizens' practice of their religion. The freedoms of speech, press, assembly, and the right to petition the government and seek redress of grievances proclaim that citizens have the right to call the government to account. Freedom of speech and press allows citizens to communicate their ideas verbally and in writing, while freedom of assembly lets them publicly express a common interest. The right to petition allows citizens to point out to the government where it did not follow the law, to seek changes as well as damages for such missteps. Of course, there are limits to these freedoms. One may not force the tenets of his or her religion on those who do not observe those beliefs. Harmful speech, such as yelling fire in a crowded room, is not protected, nor is a written lie that causes harm. As well, gatherings must be peaceful. Destruction of the property of others is not protected by the First Amendment. Liberty is to faction, political parties, or movements what air is to fire, an aliment without which it instantly expires, said James Madison, the principal framer of the Constitution. But it could not be less folly to abolish liberty, which is essential to political life, because it nourishes faction, than it would be to wish the annihilation of air, which is essential to animal life, because it imparts to fire its destructive agency.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.